Welcome to Motivated to Lead Podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. This week, we're happy to have join us Chuck Brynelson. Chuck is currently the chair of the board of directors at Envoy Medical, a publicly traded company. He serves on the board of Alibra Technologies and is a venture partner at Spring Rock Ventures. Previously, he served as the senior vice president of Abbott Vascular, and he has also served as the global president of Early Technologies at Medtronic, and has just a great background of leading organizations through periods of growth. And he's got some great insights. I know that will be helpful to you. Looking forward to today's conversation with Chuck. It's great to have Chuck joining us for our conversation this week. Appreciate you taking time out of your week to chat with us.
No, my pleasure, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Well, I always love to hear people's career stories. It's always interesting to see how somebody's career evolved. Can you give us just a little bit of your background and a little bit of your story?
Sure, be happy to. So, you know, I'm a Midwesterner, grew up in Illinois, outside Chicago, born in the city, educated in Illinois, went to Bradley University, and then ultimately a few years later, Northwestern, where I went to the business school. You know, I was kind of doing a lot of different things in college, and so I wasn't really clear on a single path, which ends up being a pretty good theme, I think, when people think back on those things, because, you know, I ended up right where I needed to be, in spite of the fact that at one point I thought about going into business, medicine, seminary. And so, you know, I finished college and my high school sweetheart and I, she had fallen behind me, I guess you could say, or I leaped ahead maybe more correctly. I had graduated high school and college in 6 years, which God only knows why. And, net decided I'd take a year off and sort of really decide what to do before going to grad school. As I looked for a job and something to do, I could pronounce big scientific terms given my science background. And so I got a job as a pharmaceutical rep. And so that's my introduction to kind of commercial activities in life sciences. A year into that, we decided to get married. And so now I needed to kind of stay working because she had another year of school to finish. And I ultimately ended up over in the medical device industry, where suddenly I saw a lot of the things that I was interested in coming together. Mm. And that being obviously medicine, science, engineering, and business. And so I landed at Medtronic in about 1981 as a rep. And from there, really, you know, just fell in love with the business. Was, you know, much of what we take for granted today hadn't been invented yet. And so, you know, through the 80s and the 90s, there were all these new platforms that were being studied and then launched that became standards of care. And, you know, as part of the field organization, we were in the operating room or the cath lab, you know, helping to educate and deploy these therapies. And much like happens today, support those even for the established therapies. So I really love that. And then, you know, ended up going out west to be sales manager. And then at some point, someone tapped me on the shoulder and said, you know, you keep talking about wanting to be a business leader, but, you know, you want to be a sales leader. We understand that. But if you want to really be a business leader, you're going to need to come in-house. So with a bit of mentoring, I took a position, left California, came to Minnesota, where I went into marketing. And of course, at that point, you come in maybe thinking you really understand how the business operates. But you have no concept really of all the things that have to happen behind the scenes to kind of develop a new product, build that product, and distribute it. And so it was quite an education. And so I did a couple things there in marketing, went back out as a regional VP with Medtronic, came back in again and was VP of marketing for the cardiac rhythm management business. And then we went through some reorganization and an opportunity occurred where I got put on the chief operating officer's staff in a developmental role with a position that was probably a misnomer because it was called corporate marketing. I had nothing to do with brand, but I had Canada and Latin America, and I had sort of B2B. And at that time, you know, the dot-com revolution was starting. And so, you know, how are we going to do things? And so in that role, we ultimately developed a strategy that became the Global Healthcare Exchange and prevented the sort of disintermediation of the channel, meaning, you know, others coming in from the dot-com world that would get in between us and our customers. And so from that experience, I got sent overseas to be president of Asia Pacific for Medtronic. Did that for a little over 2 years and then was repatriated, did a couple GM assignments. And so now here we are, you know, what I was talking about when I was in my mid-20s, we're finally doing, where now we're building a team and we're responsible for the full P&L and, you know, sort of the success or failure of the business. And so learned a lot there. And then, you know, Bill George retired and Bill had been a sponsor and mentor for me. And we started to see some changes. And so I decided that I wasn't really willing at that age to kind of just mark my time to retirement. I wanted to keep doing things. And I'd had an itch about the startup world. And so I ended up moving back to California and being CEO of a startup that was working on an implantable, active implantable device for treating obesity and metabolic disorder. That was a great education, was not such a good economic outcome. Because along the way, we had the 2008 Lehman Brothers collapse. Several obesity companies failed. And so keeping that entity financed, you know, became very difficult. So we had to make a difficult decision to sort of downsize, put it back in the incubator, put it on life support, at which point I returned to Minnesota. And then from there, I took a position with Covidien. And here's another one of these interesting things where you just can't predict what in your experiences is going to sort of lead to the next position or next opportunity. But Covidien was actively buying businesses with an idea of being, you know, able to disrupt themselves. And they'd made the very wise decision that if we acquired those businesses and we put them in with an existing operating unit, they'd probably get starved. And so what they wanted to do was create an environment where someone who understood venture-backed companies, understood sort of that world, if you will, but also had done a lot of market development, knew how to take things from infancy to being standard of care, which was a competency that, you know, Medtronic invested in pretty heavily. And so guess what? Here I am. I'm a guy that looks like what they need. And so I became the division president of a group called Early Technologies. And I think that business, frankly, had a lot to do with why Medtronic acquired Covidien, because we had, you know, all these new growth engines that we were developing. And we had a series of, you know, new verticals we were working on in some white spaces as well. Medtronic acquired. So here I am back at the company for Medtronic 2.0. And, you know, it was great to be home, so to speak. But boy, things had really changed in the, you know, sort of 10 years I'd been away. So I stuck around for about a year with the integration, and then I retired. And I very quickly realized in about 6 months' time that retirement's not just about having enough money to sort of pay for your hobbies. It's really about redefining who you're going to be. And so, you know, I was starting to kind of get a little antsy. And about this time, Abbott acquired St. Jude. And so they were out looking for people to sort of recast and sort of help them integrate the business. And here again, very wise leadership at Abbott said, you know, we've got to get people who understand medical device. We've got a lot of competencies in nutrition and, you know, pharmaceuticals and what have you. And so I ended up becoming the president of Abbott's vascular business. And I did that going into that role, telling my wife, listen, I'm going to really figure out what retirement looks like. And it's someday when we finally do it, I won't be sort of crawling the walls in 6 months' time. Of course, we went through COVID. So by the time I got to full retirement age, I thought, you know, getting back on the horse and traveling the world and being gone 60% of the time probably isn't all that it was to me once upon a time. And so I took retirement at that point. And so since then, I've been really sort of focused on, you know, A, paying back my wife for the 40 years she was waiting for me to come home. As well as, you know, trying to get back. And, you know, I'm involved with some board work. I do a little bit of private equity advisory. But, you know, a lot of what I do is just talking to people that are in leadership roles or coming up in their career and being a sounding board. And, you know, I try and kind of limit that so it doesn't become a full-time job. But at the end of the day, you know, I feel like I've had a wonderful career, great string of experiences. I've learned a lot along the way. And the best thing I can do at this point is share that and help others to sort of have a full career as well.
Yeah. Well, that's a great journey. And I'm sure if you go back and talk to a 22-year-old Chuck and say, you know, what will your career look like? It probably, you wouldn't have imagined kind of where it would take you over that time. But going back to that 22-year-old Chuck, I'd love to ask this question. What advice would you give him?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think first and foremost is slow down, take your time. You know, what looks like a long time at 22 is a heartbeat at this age. And, you know, the reversibility of decisions, I think, is another thing. You know, we look at things when we're young, kind of with a fairly linear path. You know, and I think we look at strategy the same way often, like we can go from point A to B. And the reality is research shows that you kind of zig and zag. And I think careers end up being the same way. And so I'd probably say, you know, slow down, get that graduate degree sooner, Chuck. You probably, you know, you could have done a lot of different things sooner had you decided to go to school, which I talked about for a decade, but didn't really get it done. And then, you know, I think, yeah, enjoy the ride and, you know, look at things as not being irreversible.
So talk a little bit that first leadership position that you had. Kind of you mentioned that you were in a sales leadership role, and then you were tapped on the shoulder as far as to kind of take a bigger role. Talk a little bit about that. What do you wish you would have known earlier as far as around leadership?
You know, it's interesting. I would tell you my first, and I'm going to make a distinction here between management and leadership, if I may. My first management role, I had the perfect boss to really sort of guide me and lead me and help me develop an understanding of a methodology to be successful as a manager, and ultimately that foundation of what that means for leadership. And to be honest, most of that really focused on sort of evaluating yourself. So when you looked at sort of managing others, you know, we tend to kind of view that through the prism of our own success as a salesperson. So, hey, I was great. I did it this way. Therefore, you must do it as well. But that doesn't necessarily always work. And a lot of where we fall down, I think, is around things like clarity of direction. Really, do we have someone that has the skills and we're asking them to do the right thing? Have we sort of provided them the resources? You know, all of those sorts of things, which really are management failures. And so Ed Olson, who was my boss back then, who unfortunately passed away a few years after that from cancer, a real loss, I think, to our industry, sort of defined this to me in a way where it's like, okay, if you got someone that's not performing, you know, we're going to go through a series of questions that really are about you, meaning the manager, and where you might have let the person down. And then at some point, if you tick all those boxes to the affirmative that you've done it right, well, now we're dealing with a situation where someone's decided not to do it, right? Because we've determined that they know what a good job looks like. We know they've got the skills and capabilities to do it. We know that we've resourced them appropriately. And so at this point, now it's like on their shoulders. And what's interesting about that, when the time comes to really do performance management, you've sort of pressure tested things in a way where now you've got some clear and specific feedback that you can provide. And if it ultimately comes to where you have to let someone go, you know, you can do that with a clear conscience. Interestingly, following that process, what I discovered is if you start to discuss those things with people, you know, I was amazed a number of times where people go, yeah, I know, I'm not right. I'm not a right fit for this. I should do something else. And they'd self-select out. So, you know, I think is that kind of, I feel pretty good about that. And I carried that forward throughout my career. But what I didn't really understand about that was, you know, sort of what did that mean in terms of leadership and kind of how you viewed people? You know, you tended to like, okay, I got to get this right. I'm a manager. They're measuring me. I've got my objectives. But in terms of really thinking long haul, investing in individuals, helping people to really achieve their full potential, which, you know, is very, very important, I think, to the outcome, but isn't necessarily something that we measure in a, you know, a month or a quarter or a fiscal year. And, you know, we could talk some more about that.
Sure. Yeah. Talk about, you'd mentioned Bill George as being influence on your career and the importance of mentors. What were some things that you saw modeled by great leaders that you've worked for, including Bill George and others?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, my two sort of leadership heroes, I guess, would be Warren Bennis from, you know, University of Southern California, who's sort of defined as one of the people that really, you know, started much of what Bill George has been doing today. And obviously, having had the opportunity to get to know Bill when I was a sales manager, when he would come out to California for what was then the Hambrecht-Quist Conference, now, you know, JP Morgan, was someone who really was a servant leader, was thinking a lot about the people around him and, you know, sort of the impact that he was having. The man's a genius, undoubtedly, but he goes out of his way to facilitate conversation so as to kind of develop the best thinking of a group of leaders, as opposed to just, you know, kind of the staff report out of here's my mandates, how are you doing against it? And I think that's a huge distinction. And then I think, you know, Bill's written a lot about authenticity and true north. And I think that's probably his most powerful thing. And frankly, I don't think when he first came to us from Honeywell, you know, the coin had dropped yet for him. You know, I think when Penny got ill and sort of he was evaluating his life, you know, I think all of a sudden he kind of let his defensives down and he became a lot more, you know, approachable. And not that he was ever a standoff guy, but end of the day, you know, that sort of something I think leaders don't do enough of, but it's a little bit of exposing, you know, some of your things that you're not proud about or where you might feel you're inadequate or, you know, whatever that term would be. You know, we as humans sort of get attracted to that and we look at people and say, hey, they're real. And, you know, if people are viewed as real, you know, guess what? They tend to follow you. So, you know, when I was young, someone might say, oh, you know, you're too emotional. Well, I'd say that's passion. Let's make sure we understand passion versus emotion. Emotion's a bad thing if it's getting in the way of your decision-making. Passion's something people line up behind. So, you know, I think for Bill, he, you know, really has got a body of literature now around this thing called authenticity. And I, you know, very much believe it. And I think this was something also that Warren Bennis wrote about in, you know, some of his books. And, you know, one of his quotes was around, you know, managers do things right, leaders do the right things. And I think organizations look to leaders to have a vision and to kind of guide us towards what are the right things to do. And, you know, they tend not to spend all their time kind of judging on how we do it, but giving us big guidelines, you know, principles that we can sort of do it by, and obviously have to manage. But, you know, at those higher level jobs, it's much more about the leadership, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great. Thinking about kind of leadership today, what are some of the biggest challenges that you see that are facing leaders that are coming in? And a lot of our listeners are first-time leaders or moving into the first-time CEO role. Talk a little bit about what are some things that you see that that leaders are facing that maybe you weren't facing when you were as a young leader.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I think it's an amazing time and challenging. You know, if I think about our youth, the world was much more, you know, alike than dissimilar. So the level of conformity that was required, I mean, I think back to, you know, we were all wearing 3-piece suits that were probably blue or gray and, with a vest and a red tie against a white shirt. And while there was sort of the '60s and, you know, what was going on the college campuses in the business world, it was pretty clear that, you know, walk this way, talk this way. Now, having said that, you know, along the way you had to develop kind of a path of your own and not be too conformist because you could get lost. And here again, I think this is another one of the things that Bill writes about is this idea of whatever the thread is of your life, your motivations, you need to be in harmony with that. And if you're not, you're not going to really, you know, you're not going to be happy You might be happy with the pay and how you think it's going at work, but you're really not going to be happy and you're not going to be great at what you do. And so I think we had to sort of find that way a little bit differently. Now, you know, we go to the other end of the extreme and the kids all kind of come out of school and it's, you know, all about their self-actualization and they're very nonconformist and they think they should be CEO by their 25th birthday. And I, you know, I really look at that and say, wow, that's a challenge. The whole thing about remote work, which has, I'm going to probably age myself here. While I see on one hand, particularly when I was in California, the advantage of remote work, the challenge is when you're onboarding someone, how do they get to really get embedded in the culture of the company and understand, you know, all the things that are unspoken or unwritten in terms of how to be successful there? How do you sort of ensure that there's, you know, as a leader, that ability to bring the team together and get everybody on the same page and aligned around sort of the vision you have for the business and the direction of the business. All of that strikes me as being very difficult when we're watching people on, you know, the Zoom call. And so while I think there's great utility for it and there's, you know, lots of opportunity, I think for a leader, particularly when you think about putting together a really good team, you need to know people in a deep way, in my mind. You know, I think the best teams don't look like you. They're, you know, they're a group of people that are very different from you. And you know, how do you get to know that unless you really have that sort of white space time? You know, the quote unquote water cooler time, as we've always called it, where people get to know each other and there's relationships and networks that are developed that are outside the formal meeting. And I think that's one of the challenges with Zoom calls is it's, you know, it's one formal meeting to the next formal meeting to the next formal meeting. And yeah, there's some people texting behind the scenes and some phone calls happening, but you just wonder if it develops the same kind of relationships. And so I would think, you know, as a leader, you got to really be thinking about that and how can you fill in that gap? Because in my mind, one of the secrets of my success, I believe, as a manager leader was really around kind of getting to know people and their motivations and understanding kind of what's the journey that they're on. And then seeing if there's a way that I could sort of match that to the needs of the organization and to the objectives that we had. And I always felt like if I could do that, now I don't really have to be overly managing people that, you know, they're going to get up every day now that it's sort of triggered by their own motivations and how they're sort of perceiving their self-actualization. They're far more motivated to get up in the middle of the night and do things than I am, you know, sort of calling them and reminding them I need them at, you know, on that call with Tokyo at whatever hour. And so again, I think it's a challenge. There's extra, you probably have to be extra methodical and find ways to do things in order to build that. If you believe that culture is important, if you believe that motivating people is in my mind, not only about how you present yourself. And so we've talked a little bit about authenticity, but also in terms of what you know about your team and how to best motivate them or, you know, align them with kind of the organization.
So as a leader moves into that first leadership role, a lot of times they're like, okay, I have to figure out everything about the organization and have to feel like I have to be the smartest person in the room. Talk a little bit about that mentality and kind of what you would recommend to a new leader and how they're going to allocate their time and their resources.
Yeah, great question. Well, I mean, first and foremost, try not to be the smartest person in the room because it turns the other people off.
Right.
And I think that, you know, the research shows that regardless of what functional background we come from, you know, as a new general manager, guess what you focus on? That which you know. And so if anything, you might also be shortchanging some of the other functions. So I think, you know, you go into this with sort of let's be in learning mode and, you know, give yourself 90, 100 days to really sort of get to know everyone and really have them teach you about sort of what it is that they do and what does success in their organization look like and how what they do kind of supports the overall organization. And while you may have done this role before, oh, wait a second, we're talking about someone that hasn't, you know, I think you will learn so much. And then, you know, what ultimately I think as a general manager, you need are functional experts that you can rely upon, people that speak with you in the sort of language of finance and the P&L and business strategy, but go off and develop products or run clinical trials or do regulatory filings, which are things that you may understand kind of in a sort of abstract, broad way, but they should be really deep experts on it. And then in my definition of the perfect team, if you're hiring to put it together, you also want to get people who, you know, sort of think like general managers. And if anything, I always would sort of call that out specifically as a desire. So even if you're going in to a new role and there's an established team, hey, you know, you can set the tone for how that team's going to work together and ask them, listen, I need you to weigh in on everything. Your role here is sort of twofold. One is that you are the expert on your function and we have expectations around that, but also that you're a part of this management team. And so we're going to be making, you know, the big decisions for the business. And it isn't just the guy sitting at the end of the table that's going to make those, but we as a team. So you're going to need people that have the courage to speak truth to power, tell you when you're not like on the right path, Chuck, have sort of the ability to collaborate, that also don't think they're the smartest person in the room. And so they can also listen and, you know, deal with sort of contrarian or opinions that are different from their own. But I think the more you get that, I think that's where you get really great decisions. And I think one of the concerns I would tell you I have about sort of the road we're on with DEI, and not to get into political conversation, but just that, you know, having worked abroad and worked in an industry where there's a lot of people that came from all over the globe, but we all had a common sort of goal regarding extending life and helping people. You know, there's some really brilliant people that don't look like you and I, Mark, that haven't come from our backgrounds. And we need to make sure they're on the team giving us perspective, not to fill a quota, but because that makes us stronger. And so being a facilitator of those conversations, creating a safe environment for people to have those conversations, to participate, I think that comes back to being a really good leader as opposed to the guy that's just managing, you know, the objectives and how we're doing against that.
So what books would you put on a leader's read list that you think would be helpful and that maybe has made a, you know, definitely an impact in your leadership?
Yeah, so I would probably mention three, you know, and again, they're all dated, so I apologize. But I think these themes are pretty universal and timeless and they get rewritten about. But I think Stephen Covey's work, you know, years ago on the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People and some of the work around that I thought was very good, because for me, it gave me a framework for a lot of things I already thought and believed. And it just kind of helped me to organize that. And I think for someone, whether coming in new to this or sort of being early, it's helpful. Warren Bennis's book on becoming a leader. We've mentioned a couple of the themes there. And I think, you know, around developing sort of vision, really how to think about people, you know, most organizations, maybe not most, but many organizations view people as just interchangeable is one of the things he writes about. And the idea that, you know, you got to let great people do what they're really good at and want to do. And that gets at a little bit of why I think about sort of understanding people and trying to motivate them through their own motivations. And then Bill George, who we've, you know, obviously mentioned already in his True North series. And here again, I think I read Bill's first book, and I used to sort of, I was secretary to the XCOM when Bill was there before I got sent to Asia. And so, I mean, I had the front row seat. And so I viewed it a little bit differently than he wrote it. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's a great series. And he's obviously, you know, had a wonderful career post Medtronic. And, you know, so I would look at those three. I think that even for someone that, you know, is looking, reading whatever the latest and greatest is, I think those three would be useful.
Any quotes that you like to refer to?
Well, again, I mentioned the one already from Warren Bennis, the sort of leaders, managers doing things right, leaders doing the right things. And, you know, maybe to unpack that one a little bit, for me, there's sort of this idea of vision and what that means. But I think it also gets at, you know, this, as I said in business school once, everything's in a 2x2 matrix. And if you were to plot importance, you know, against urgency, most of us spend our time on the things that are important and urgent. But then if we go to sort of unimportant urgent, and we need to really be able to kind of sort of triage that one out of the way and focus on important but not urgent, because in the long haul, particularly for leaders, that's the one that you got to make sure you're doing, and it's not in front of you every day. And so I think, you know, Warren speaks to a little bit about that. Yeah, I don't have a great Bill George quote. Sorry.
So outside of work, and it sounds like you probably have been catching up on some hobbies and things that you do. But what do you like to do to recharge?
Yeah, you know, my personal life revolves around the three F's, I would say. And notwithstanding some of the things that you and I have talked about offline, you know, it's family first. And I'm blessed to, you know, still be married to the same woman. We've got two adult sons who live locally, which is why we continue to be here. And they both have families. And so we have six grandchildren. And so, you know, making sure we take time to, you know, spend with not only my wife, but with our children and their wives and their children, you know, is certainly a blessing that we're enjoying. And, you know, I think it's important to kind of remember who we work for. And why we work, you know, not to get too obsessed with what we do. And then I've got two other hobbies. So I fly. And I would tell you that flying is one of those things that, you know, it takes a fair amount of your attention and focus. And the beauty of that is it sort of pushes the other things out of the way. And so when you go off and fly, it's a great escape from whatever the pressures may be. And I found that when I was working, and I still find it to be very relaxing today for that benefit of just kind of getting a clear. And of course, hey, the view from up there is fantastic, right? And then my third hobby is fishing. And, you know, I think to me, it doesn't get much better than standing at the base of a mountain in a mountain stream, trying to outwit a little fish to keep one humble. And to have perspective. You know, again, I went out to the mountains as a young kid to visit some family, and just, you know, when you're standing there and you look at the magnitude and size of that, it really causes one to sort of reconsider their importance in the world. And so I just love the outdoors. And obviously when we can outwit that little guy and get him on the end of the line, that's great fun as well. But those are the things. And yeah.
So what parting advice would you give a new or up and coming leader?
So I think, you know, be authentic, be you, find a way for you to sort of be married to what it is that you do. And if you can't do that, then I think you should think about doing something different. And that's not the end of the world. It's your life. It's not your mother's or your dad's or what your boss thinks. And those are all important inputs, not to sort of minimize them. But at the end of the day, when you're looking back after 40 or 50 years of this, you know, hopefully you've been you and you've been able to do what you want to do. We've talked a lot today about authenticity. And I would just say that here again, as part of being you, that makes you more authentic to the people. And just to really recognize early in your career that people are very perceptive, and our radar around when people are kind of telling us something or packaging themselves as something we know they're not really is something that kind of detracts from your effectiveness. And so I think, you know, doing that. And then the last thing is, you know, we spend over a third of our lives at work. It should be fun. It should be enjoyable. It should be challenging. It should be something that really fulfills us. And whether that's through the work you do, the passion you have for it, whether it's through the relationships that you build, but each step of the way, you're going to have the opportunity to learn from others and help others and get to know others. And, you know, that just is invaluable. I mean, I think that's really the fabric of life and the richness of that. And so enjoy that versus, you know, sitting there thinking, okay, I'm going to mark the cell wall for the next 35 years, get the gold watch, and then I can have some fun. Wrong approach.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.